term, so make sure you signed in as an alternate or your voting seat. Thanks.
Trigger out.
Folks, I've been notified that we've reached a quorum. Sylvia, if you would bolt both of those doors so that no one can leave, we'll get started. I need a motion for approval of the minutes.
Second.
Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor?
Aye.
This is my last chair meeting that I'll preside over. So if you'll indulge me for just 2 minutes or so. First of all, I want to thank all of you for your service throughout the year. We've done a lot of work, a lot of it very good work, and I appreciate your help with that. I want to thank all the committee chairs, standing committee chairs, for the work they did. Sometimes they had to be arm twisted into doing that duty, but all of them, regardless of their sore arms, did very, very well this year. I'm hoping some of them will think about coming back for the new administration. As to the new administration, I want to thank those folks who stepped up and put themselves up to the vote for our new officers for next year. Margaret Crowder, chair, Jennifer Hanley, back for the sequel, and Heidi Alvarez, secretary. So when you see those folks, give them a pat on the shoulder for their willingness to do service. I've said this before in a lot of different settings, but I'll say it again. I don't take myself very seriously, but I take the work that I do very seriously. And so I know from time to time some people may have been rubbed the wrong way by my levity, but you know, sometimes a good laugh gets things moving along. And I certainly don't mind if they're at my expense. That happens quite often. I had a meeting with the senator from the School of Journalism who will replace me next fall. Earlier today, he was just wanting to know about Senate stuff. And so I was getting ready to leave, and he asked that question, so in 4 years on the Senate, what have you learned? You know, so it always comes to learning outcomes. And they're important. And I didn't have to think about it very long. I said, well, I've learned a lot of things, but what really struck me is budget presentations. I've sat through many of them, like you have, and you all know the drill. When the first pie chart comes up that shows how we spend our money, they always start with fixed costs. And I've aspired to be a lot of things in my life: cowboy, barber. About it. But having served in the Senate now for 4 years, and as a faculty at Western, faculty member at Western Kentucky, I now aspire to be a fixed cost. You go ahead and laugh, but that budget presentation says these are the things that are essential to the university, and we have to pay for them. And every year we seem to have to pay a little more for them. And to me, nothing better describes the faculty at this university than us being a fixed cost. And I would suggest that if they turned off the water and they turned off the power and they shut down everything that was in that fixed cost budget, that this faculty could still teach and our students would still learn. So I'm proud of all the work you've done. I think we've established a strong voice this year, and I hope we continue going forward. Thanks for your patience and your help. Jennifer, the sequel.
Nothing, but I would like to say thank you. You have made this a very good Senate year, and I thank all of you as well, because this is definitely a concerted effort with a lot of time involved and invested, and I appreciate the privilege of serving as vice chair again this year, and I appreciate it for next year, so thank you very much.
Thank you, too, and please make sure, yes. If you've not gotten Jennifer updated with replacements to yourselves, or if you're new, or if something's changing, make sure so she can keep that role up to date, so I can pass on a clean role to the next chair. Molly's not here, but I understand Patty have a brief gospel note.
A one sentence one. Am I after Molly anyway?
Yep.
Okay, let's just combine.
Okay.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. On behalf of COSFL, a one-sentence report. While we're handing out applause, I want to give a big, big round of applause for the one member of the CPE who had the courage to defy basically what was a political shakedown and to vote for the 5% tuition increase. That was the faculty representative to the CPE, Nancy McKinney, teaches at EKU where they've had a layoff. And they have cut 10% out of their budget. So she knows all about the pain. And I applaud her courage for doing that. There was one abstention, Carolyn Ridley, who is representative from here in Bowling Green. And if you know Ms. Ridley, then please give her some thanks as well. But that's not an easy thing to do. I know what it's like to be the lone dissenter. It's not always fun. And big important people don't call me and tell me how to vote. So good for her. Good for her. It's hard. I could probably cut this down to 30 seconds and say, yes, we aspire to be fixed cost. I think that's beautifully put, Mac. As you know from the news reports, the full Board of Regents met on April 26th, and we are meeting two more times this summer. We have the called budget meeting, which will be on June 21st. Then we have two-day Board of Regents retreat at the end of July, so you'll hear quite a bit from me this summer. The board meeting on 26th, much to my surprise, there were two items added to the agenda at the meeting immediately after the board rose from closed session. That is extremely unusual. The two items were property acquisitions for the proposed Honors College building. And to be clear, that is what the building is called in the two action agenda items. It is called Honors College Building. The first item asked the board to approve the Honors College site selection and to authorize the purchase of 1580 Normal Street, which is the Chi Omega House, for $240,000 to be funded by future agency bond issue, which will be brought before the board in late October at its fourth quarterly meeting. The second agenda item requested approval of a resolution which authorized the university to procure property at 1590 Normal Drive, the Hillcrest Apartments, by condemnation pursuant to taking by eminent domain as allowed for in KRS 164.410. At such time as this condemnation action is complete, the action item authorizes the university to purchase the property from agency bond revenue. So again, this is the agency bond revenue that has not been approved yet. The agency bond issue will be on the October board agenda. So the total cost of these two property actions will be, and again, it's not clear because once you enter into condemnation proceedings, then there has to be a state appraisal of that property. But ballparking it, probably going to be at the lowest $1.1 million. So after the closed session, the board came back into open session to vote on the two property agenda items, and the vote was 7-2, with Regent Corey Dodds and myself voting no. And to quote myself from the Bowling Green Daily News, which was an accurate quote, "This building is a want. It is most certainly not a need." And if you want more commentary on this, I know a lot of people don't know that the Herald did a digital issue last week. It's very good. So check it out, and be sure to check out the editorial page, which I think is particularly on point. Since the board meeting, the president has announced publicly the size and the scope of the budget cuts. Now, one good thing has come of this: the end of the use of the Higher Education Price Index to escalate most of the student fees. You may remember at the called board meeting in April to vote on the Conference USA issue, I asked the president publicly to stop using the HEPI escalator for the student athletic fee and to move away from student subsidized model for athletics to a self-supporting model for athletics. On April 24th, the Student Government Association approved a resolution asking for the same thing. Now, it is very seldom that we see such quick results on this type of issue, and I thank our partners in the Student Government Association for their timely resolution and their teamwork to make this happen. And this is further proof that we are stronger when faculty and student leaders work together for the common good. But that's the only silver lining I see here. The president's email to campus on May the 8th details a total budget cut of $2,139,000. And aside from the public cuts that you have read about, there are very real cuts that have been made in other places. There have been part-time budget cuts, which means a real reduction in the workforce on this campus and a very real reduction in the number of sections offered to our students. Cuts don't get any more real than that. Funding for benefits remains flat. This is a potential problem down the road, and I'd like to ask our Senate representatives for a Benefits Committee report to the Senate this fall when the picture for 2014 is finally clear. The university stakeholders need to know what's going on with our self-funded insurance program in the absence of increased university contribution. Now, when you break it all down, if you've graphed it, 48.9% of the budget cuts, which is close to a majority, went to academics in one form or another. And that's not okay. This is a university. Academics is our business. Everything else is support for the mission. There are two administrative units that did not have any cuts. The athletic cut is being spread. It's 5%, but it's being spread over 5 years, so it's 1% per year. When we look at the statewide picture, I don't see anything that gets any better. The Commonwealth's financial health is precarious, with a 10% reduction in revenue projected for this year, which means there is no chance we're going to get a funding increase. This is projected to continue for at least the next 2 years, perhaps longer. President Ransdell, to his and his administrative council's great credit, were able to avoid a layoff of full-time employees. I don't know that we'll be so lucky next time. And that is cold, hard fact. That's not hyperbole. So looking ahead to the fall, the Board of Regents will be asked in October to authorize the issuing of agency bonds to build a $22 million Honors College building. We cannot afford to do it. We cannot take an agency bond, debt service on which would be $1.4 million annually, for 30 years. So again, $1.4 million. The entire cut for this year is $2.1 million. There is no reason that this project cannot be delayed until the university is in better fiscal health than it is now, or will be hopefully in the next 2 years. It is fiscally irresponsible to fund wants when we may very well not have the money to fund needs. This is the rare issue that affects every single person on this campus. Every faculty member, part-time, full-time, every staff member, every student. No one gets to take a pass on this one. No one gets to say, well, I just don't really want to be involved, so you worry about it. No, everybody has to hold the stake on this one. If this has not affected you yet, it may very well next year. If it doesn't affect you next year, it's the year after that. And frankly, if you teach, do research, ever engage in professional development or travel to conferences, trust me, it affects you right now. So we need to unite on this message. In these difficult times, we fund needs, not wants. And funding needs will be increasingly difficult. I, too, want all of us to remain fixed costs. We already see the impact that the cuts have had on our teaching, our research, and our professional development. I take a lot of votes as faculty regent, but there are few votes that I will ever take that matter as much as this one will. And it's one of the few that cannot be undone. Whenever we create a program, and by that I mean anything, you create academic programs, you create new colleges, you create athletic or extracurricular endeavors, we fund them, but we also have the power to eliminate them. But if you're a Harry Potter fan, the agency bond is like the unbreakable vow. We got some in here. Okay, good. You know what happens to people who break the unbreakable vow, right? It is an obligation we take for 30 years on which we cannot default, no matter how unstable the rest of our situation becomes. Read the Chronicle of Higher Education. Read the trades in your particular discipline, and you're going to see what a lot of these agency bonds or private institutions that have taken on debt for building on campus, you see what it's doing them to them already, and it makes them even more dependent on enrollment growth than they already are. So we have already seen several of these obligations take a chunk of our budget. This would push us well past 5% if we were to pass this agency bond. Over 5% of our total budget would be debt. In short, we would mortgage the university's future. So I think my colleague gets it right. I want to be a fixed cost, and I want you to remain one too. One final point related to your good service this year. The internal auditor is looking at the study abroad issue, the study abroad fee issue. And their report will be made to the Board of Regents on June 21st, probably during the Financial Committee. This is a very good thing, as the Board has a fiduciary responsibility to maintain transparency and accountability on all fiscal matters. And again, thanks to you and our partners in Student Government Association, you have shown how important this issue is to you and the rest of the campus. I want to thank everybody for your great teamwork this year and for your insights and your comments. I will be back in touch after the budget meeting on June 21st, but in the meantime, please don't ever hesitate to get in touch with me. And thank you for doing such a great job.
Thanks, Patty. Dr. Emsley? I have SGA as a C.
Oh, okay.
You guys want to arm wrestle?
There were 16 and a half recommendations from the Senate last time. I'm going to go through these quite quickly, I hope, if I can find them. One, Graduate Council fined, two, UCC, and then a subsequent recommendation fixing a clerical error, both approved. Recommendation 03 in student production policy, requesting that no further action be taken. No further action has, to this point, been taken. Action 4 on the program coordinator policy, approved. 5 through 10 were Colonnade courses, approved. 11 through 14 were faculty handbook revisions. They are pending. I want to kind of get the whole set, including the ones in today's agenda, in one place, and then we can look at the whole package. 15, study abroad application fee. I'll discuss that just in a minute. And then a subsequent one, I'm not quite sure, something about my math program. It's a addendum, I guess, to the UCC report, which was filed as number 16. That was also approved. Let me talk about this study abroad application fee. I find this a little confusing, the wording of the fee. It said, and I quote, that the fee be applied to all WKU students and all WKU students in all programs of which the fee will be assessed. And I didn't quite understand that. So here's what's actually happening. We'll cut this short. As already agreed to or approved, the fee for all faculty-led study abroad courses for spring and summer of 13 study abroad experiences has been, or if it hasn't been, will be refunded either through an augmentation of the World Topper Scholarship Award or, if necessary, through a refund to the student StopNet account. Fine. It is my understanding that the original Senate recommendation, which was 2013-02-10, stated that the Senate understands new revenues are important to the welfare of the study abroad office, but that the main issue was that, quote, the fee was implemented after the pricing structures were already in place. With that in mind, what we've done, we had just a meeting two or three days ago, and all students who applied, and again, it's an application fee, not a participation fee. All students who applied to any study abroad prior to January 30th, when the fee was kind of publicly announced, for any study abroad program, whether it be Keys, CCSA, Harlequin, Semester at Sea, faculty led, whatever, we'll have that fee return. And this time we'll just do it as a straight reimbursement to the TopNet account. Any application that occurred after January 30th, when the fee was well known and in open view, that fee will remain. And as Regent Minder mentioned, the whole matter of course and program fees in general, all the lab fees, the program fees, whatever, including, if necessary, the study abroad application fee, will be the subject of not only an internal audit that Bailey Jordan is carrying out right now, but will be an agenda item in the June 21st special COP meeting of the board to discuss the budget, which is also, by the way, an academic affairs committee meeting. There'll be a variety of academic affair programs, such as what comes out of this meeting today, will be on that as well. So that's my response to 15, and I believe I was asked to respond at this meeting, and that's what I just did. Patty mentioned enrollment. Reasonably good gauge of enrollment is how we're doing the summer, and that's pretty steady. It's interesting watching the numbers because they fluctuate quite wildly. As little as a week or so ago, we were looking at, I believe, a 400 and something headcount deficit, and suddenly 1 week later, that deficit was down to less than 100. And that's because we have various drop dates that aren't the same from year to year and so on. I am, however, told that the number of students dropped for non-payment this summer was less than half what it was last year, which I see is a very encouraging sign that students are committing. We have the scholarship program in place. And last time I looked at a fall enrollment report, we were up 61 new freshmen. There is still an issue with what I call the bubble going through, which has now moved on to the juniors. It was the sophomores last year, the freshmen the year before that. If you have fewer sophomores, you're going to have fewer juniors. And I know we're all working hard at retention. I encourage you to keep working hard at retention. For addressing that bubble will be very key to the total enrollment. The total tuition shortfall for the fiscal year we are currently ending was about $656,000. And typically, academic affairs is responsible for about 70% of that. I get 70% of the growth, so it's only reasonable I contribute 70% of a decline. And in addition, we over-budgeted the amount for the nursing programs that are run out of a separate budget in the health complex, the new building that will be opening downtown in August. I'll be able to recover approximately $200,000 from that. So the net cost to academic affairs, where I previously thought might be as high as $1 million, may only be about $200,000 or $300,000 of one-time funds. That's extremely good news because it means that I will have a substantial carry forward of one-time funds into next year to address a lot of issues that perhaps, you know, the budget cut may seem to be impacting, in as much as just reducing a budget line for an item does not mean that that item will not continue in some shape or form. So don't know the details yet, but I wanted to give you that little bit of optimistic news. I think it's important, as well as we look at what has been cut in the budget, to look at what has been protected. All faculty searches previously authorized are continuing. All failed searches will continue for another year, as previously. The staffing plan for next year, all vacated faculty lines, and I suspect there'll be fewer than normal. We had a somewhat lower than normal retirement rate this year. But the staffing plan will be business as usual. Except deans get 75% of their vacant positions to fill starting July 1. The other 25% plus any growth money we can find goes into phase 2. We protected the 2% raise, at least we made that permanent for all employees that received it. A portion of the staffing plan for fiscal 14, money we could have spent on searches next year, as the president's message said $500,000, that's correct to one significant digit, I believe it's more like $470,000, but it's about $360,000 plus benefits, which we had kept in reserve just in case, that we did now manage to apply to a market equity plan, of which approximately 200 faculty are eligible to receive market equity adjustments. I am not final yet, but I have seen numbers ranging from a few hundred dollars to several thousand dollars of proposed adjustments and recommendations from the deans. So for at least for a couple hundred people, those who have traditionally have received salaries at the lowest relative to our benchmarks, I think there's some good news there. And that's about all I have on that. One more thing. At the last Senate meeting, I presented this initiative called CAHEA, or whatever, the Adult Education Alliance. I'd really appreciate it. I know summer's busy for you folks. If we had some kind of campus committee or something, Mac, to advise me on how WKU should get involved in this and to what extent and in what roles we should play. We're moving quite quickly in this. The provosts are meeting this Friday to discuss progress. I am chair of the subcommittee on delineating the administrative structure, if you like. There are other subcommittees designed to explore pricing structures, role of faculty, and so forth. But I think it's important that WKU is going to play a lead role in this, as I think it can, that the faculty get involved. So this cannot wait till the fall, unfortunately. So I'm asking Mac to appoint a 5 or 6 person, perhaps, set of folks to advise me and the other folks on the team how to proceed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. SGA?
Hello, everyone. I'm Kiana Boca. I'm the new student body president and student regent. I was just sworn in last Tuesday at our banquet. And so we just had our KLA retreat this past week. Myself and our executive committee went to Barron River State Lodge, and we just got back this afternoon, and I came straight here. And I look forward to working with you all, and if I can answer any questions or be any help to any of you all, please let me know. Thank you.
Thank you. Way back in the fall, we elected one of our colleagues to the Budget Council, and that's Eric Reed. And Eric is here to give his report.
Hi, everybody. I'm Eric Reed. I'm your representative to the university's Budget Council. We met twice in the spring, and here's my update. To this point, the Budget Council has not played a role in budget decision making. It's had no role in deciding the recently announced budget cuts. It has not seen a draft of the budget plan that Dr. Ransdell will present in June, and I think it's generally unclear what role the Budget Council is going to play in decision making. But that being said, I can give you some thoughts. First of all, I'm glad to hear that Dr. Emsley is fighting to protect our academic funding, and I urge him to fight even harder to do that. But I think we need to put the recent budget issues into some perspective. First of all, the budget cut that Dr. Ransdell revealed last week is not the end of a short-term crisis caused by the CPE's refusal to allow us to raise tuition by 5%. I see it instead as the latest manifestation, the cuts that we're going to experience, as the latest manifestation of long-term deficiencies in funding that are in part our own fault. They're partly our own fault because we make decisions and spending choices that make it difficult to fund academic activities adequately. The best example of this trend is the one that Dr. Minter alluded to a few minutes ago, the spending plans, assuming that the board approves them. We'll be cutting academic programs next year. We'll be closing classroom space. We'll be defunding teaching and research activities. We'll be letting some of our part-time colleagues go. Yet at the same time, we'll also be spending nearly $1.5 million of tuition money, taking it out of circulation in order to build an honors building. I repeat that these long-term funding deficiencies are in part our own fault, and the effects of budget cutting already are accumulating to the point, and I think you can all understand this, that they're undermining everyday academic operations. What exactly do I mean by that? Some of you in this room have probably received communication from me, and I appreciate you getting in touch with me when I contacted you. I've been in touch with dozens of faculty members in every college at the university. I asked them to tell me about the effects of recent belt tightening that's been going on even before the application of the upcoming budget cuts. Faculty in every college report that their departments and colleges have already experienced Some or all of the following: reductions in upper level and lower level course offerings, cuts to the number of sections offered in multi-section courses, reductions in teaching staff, cuts to department budgets, reductions in the services offered by faculty and departments to the university, students, and the public, reductions in research and professional development funds and release time for those, declines in research productivity as faculty take on larger teaching loads, more students in their classes, or other duties they didn't previously do, and difficulty in recruiting for study abroad due to cost shifting to students in the form of assessing new fees and requiring students to pay for things that normally were paid for by the university before recently. So why are these trends important? I think it's obvious. The possible medium and long-term implications of these trends on student recruitment, retention, and graduation rates are pretty obvious. The ongoing effects of these trends on faculty morale, productivity, effectiveness, and esprit de corps are obvious as well. So what's to be done? The Senate needs to take strong, repeated public stands about spending priorities at the university. We must repeat the message that the ongoing process of cannibalizing the academic budgets has to end. We must insist that backfilling of the everyday academic budget begin immediately. We must insist that spending on basic essentials like teaching, offering courses, and supporting faculty research be ramped up, not ramped down. So thank you for listening, and feel free to contact me anytime with any questions that you have. Thank you.
Standing committee reports, Graduate Council. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? UCC report.
I also will rise for the final time.
I think you said you were going to pull the form.
What?
Yeah. Oh, John. You can never make this job easy. That'd be nice. That'd be a good one.
I would like to approve the UCC report with the exception of one form, the create new degree form. Otherwise, everything else.
Have a second? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Academic quality?
No report.
Faculty welfare?
No report.
We're on a roll. General education? Old business. Back during the April meeting, we approved the UCC report. The report had been submitted in two parts, other things and then policies. Came to my attention that the policy portions of the report was not posted on the website. Technically, it has to be posted a week prior to the meeting. So all we're doing now is approving the policies portion of the April UCC report. A motion for.
I'll move from seat to chair.
All right.
I'd like to move that we approve the policy recommendations of the UCC committee.
Second.
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye. Those a discussion. I'm sorry.
So I think this can just be answered directly regarding the prior learning portfolio.
Sure.
In terms of assigning who is going to be responsible for the development of the committee that reviews the portfolio, that's not delineated here. So when I spoke with the registrar, I was told that there would be an implementation committee, but I don't see that implementation committee mentioned here.
The way they explained it to us is that the office will coordinate with the department head to identify a specific faculty member to review the portfolio. And that both from the department department and the individual faculty member will receive compensation to the faculty's time to review the portfolio.
But that's not in here at all.
No, that part of the policy is not in here. There are also other questions at the table that I tried to answer was what kind of, do they get a letter? My understanding is it's pass-fail, so it just appears as transfer credit on their transcript. They won't have it decided. It just says they get 3 credit hours, transfer again as this program.
And if this is approved by the committee and the department head, there is no collegiate oversight and no other oversight regarding that approval.
I believe that is a fair statement. It doesn't go before another committee at that point,
though. Okay.
In fairness, though, I have this transfer credit from another institution.
Understood. Will that be delineated somewhere a little more formally soon?
I would, if that's the way you feel, make certain it is.
It would be good.
I would suggest this being tabled, pending that update, because I'm not certain that I, as a, do we ask? Typically, what happens when you get changes in the past is you send it back to the UCC and UCC ends up with an internal to get changes on the fees.
Is the registrar willing to accept a friendly amendment in some way that would outline the identification of an implementation committee explicitly such that it can be, such that they will identify all the policies a little more clearly?
Since my name is listed as the contact
yes.
person, I don't want to speak for the University College, which really
very well, okay.
And that and the University College
Okay, so I'm not really sure exactly how to proceed at this. I don't want, is it necessary that this get approved now?
Well, this is approving the policy, then the procedures, typically whatever a policy is approved, procedures are worked out administratively. And I would see this the same, this body just being asked to approve the policy.
Okay.
And then the procedures, it's, you know, it's mentioned that the faculty assessors, then the credit will be approved by the department and the dean. So there's that line of
thinking. Okay.
And in terms of step by step how it's being done, that's yet to be worked out by the University College.
May I encourage you then to simply make sure that when those policies are decided on, that they become a part of written policy somewhere. The procedures, mm-hmm. Yes, the procedures. That they become something. What I'm worried about here is that this is going to be done differently in every department, and I don't want that. I want this to be consistent. And I want it to be very clear how this what the appropriate procedure is. And I don't have an objection to the procedure as outlined. In fact, I think that's a fine procedure. I just want to make sure that we're all doing the same thing. Thank you.
Dr. Ansley, did you?
Yeah, I just want to pick it. Did this emerge from the recommendations of a 2008 task force, which essentially didn't get as far as recommending procedures? I'm sorry. This document emerged from the findings of a 2008 task force, which didn't get as far into procedures. I'd be more than happy to entertain, you know, Senate recommendation and procedure and stuff. It does say that the consensus recommendation reviewers is approved by the department head and dean of the college. So there is a collegiate oversight in the policy as written. If you want to add an academic affairs level to that, we can do so. But yeah, I would welcome. I think it's important today, especially with a long break for the next Senate meeting, to know that we can get this moving. This will not happen overnight, but it's important for certain people to know that it's on the table. This could be very important for this adult learner initiative that I mentioned. And we're one of the few, but there are at least 3 other universities in the state already doing this to varying degrees. So I would certainly welcome any addenda that the Senate or any other group would wish to propose.
I think at this time, there's not a formal addenda, but we do want to I just want to make clear that it is intended to be a faculty-approved process. It's not going to be reviewed by, in other words, somebody in the university is giving geography and geology credit for a course. It will originate from within the geography and geology.
I think that's clear in the policy.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that each
department does it.
Yes.
We're doing the same thing.
Yes.
Monotheosy, psychology. What's not clear in the policy is whether students would take a course within the unit that they're trying to get credit, or if they take a course
in
some other unit.
You are explicitly not allowed to apply for credit in a course that you're currently enrolled in.
No, what I mean is, to get the credit within a particular unit's program, does a student have to complete the portfolio course within that unit?
No.
Or are they free to take it with other units?
Portfolio course is a university college class.
Well, what would qualify the person teaching the course to know the learning outcomes for the different units?
That's why the department gets involved.
Yeah, the course is a university-level course on how to create a portfolio. Once the portfolio is created by the student seeking the credit, that's evaluated by the home unit that would award the equivalent academic credit. The course is a three-hour course, and the instructor for that course, again, this gets into procedures, Matt, that would probably go to a KEL training session, KEL, Council on Adult Extended Learning, that would, help qualify the person to teach this course and to engage students in the preparation of their portfolio.
Can I follow up? I think one concern is what would qualify that person to know of the learning outcomes?
Well, the point is that they don't create the portfolio. They don't take the class to create the portfolio. They take the class to find out what goes in a portfolio. Then they contact, let's say, you to find out, all right, this is the class that I want to create a portfolio for, what goes in. And then using the template, essentially, they fill in the bits and pieces that fulfill what your requirements are. Then you review them, and then they get awarded academic credit. So it's not, the UC college is not teaching them what content to put in. They're teaching them more on this is how you organize it and best present your past life's work for credit at the university.
Robert, and then Guy.
I guess the question I had was, I cannot find it here.
Use the microphone, please.
Is there a limit on how many hours of credit a student may receive for one portfolio?
30. I think it's 30. I'm trying to find
it. We asked them that question, and as I recall, it was 3 hours. Is that correct?
No, it's not addressed. It's how much for one portfolio.
So it would be possible for a student to create a portfolio and ask for 9 hours of credit? 12 hours of credit?
Correct. And then it's up to the assessor to determine if a student has fulfilled the learning outcome that would be equivalent to 3, 6, or 9 hours.
I have to say, I have a little bit of trouble with that, sort of a expandable portfolio that can, up to one. Because the only limit is how many total hours in a major or the program. I'm not sure. I think we need more clarity on just how much can be applied for through this process at any one time.
Okay. Robert, I understand your question. So if I have learned calculus somehow at Khan Academy or whatever, under our three-hour calculus courses, can I apply for that as a block of nine? Because I understand calculus. I mean, it'd be difficult sometimes to divide that out into calculus 1, 2, 3. But the limit for the total hours total is 1/4 of the credit for the degree, so that'd be 30. But there may be cases where I think the blocks are naturally 6 or 9 hour blocks. I suspect most would be 3. But
would it be a safe assumption is it safe to say that this portfolio development course is tantamount to giving a student 3 credits to help them apply for credits? Does that trouble anyone? That's my question. I mean, it seems I don't see the problem, any problem with evaluating a portfolio within my field and then assigning credits depending on whether or not that experience is credit worthy. But, you know, creating a course that's a 3-credit university course where I'm effectively helping them apply, and then I could be on the committee that evaluates the portfolio at the end of the process. It seems a bit excessive to offer a course that is effectively an application assistance course. I'm wondering, is the intent different? What's the intent of the course in terms of what the student actually learns within the field that they wish to get those credits in?
Yes.
We have departmental exams. The university undergraduate catalog says that students can take departmental exams essentially if they have knowledge and those can be offered for any class. And I know we've given departmental exams for upper division classes before. If someone has learned calculus on their own, we already have a university policy that allows them to take a test and get credit for that class. So the prior learning experience, I guess I don't see why we need that policy, but I think if we're going to have that policy, that we should be able to trust the people in the departments to protect the academic integrity of their own programs. And the fact that it's approved by 2 faculty, approved at the college level by the deans, I think that would be enough for me. However, I would prefer to say, you know, if you've learned this much, if you have this prior learning experience, take the departmental exam, pass the departmental exam, and get credit.
Any other discussion?
Mayor?
Yes.
Larry Snyder. I was on the original committee that helped put this together, and then it got stalled and sort of been revamped, and I don't have any vested interest in the policy that's before you. I will say that the question about departmental exams is missing the point. The point here is we have folks who have been out of higher education for a very long time doing other kinds of professional things. They're coming back. Frankly, they're not going to take a test in art history. They're coming back with sort of experience in leadership or industry that might be taken as a block and applied towards the graduation, not specific courses within your majors. And so the point was to find some way to evaluate not just their experience but their knowledge and then apply it as a whole. And there are various national models out for doing this. We don't have to make it up on our own. So the point then of giving them some credit, maybe it doesn't need to be 3 hours, but again, the point is for many of these folks coming back to school, actually figuring out how to put things together in a systematic way in a university setting is a learning experience for itself and has educational value. And so helping them to navigate and understand how a university system works and then bring them back in the system, the committee thought was probably valuable. I must admit, first time that was pitched, I said, absolutely no way. You don't give folks credit to prepare to do something. The more we talked about it, the more we looked at the national models out there and the purpose of that particular course to help them enter into the system and learn how to do it, I found that to be a fairly useful exercise. Thank you.
Robert.
Has the University College portfolio course already been created? Was it brought to the Senate's attention that this was going to be the basis of this policy? That it was going to be the key to giving credit for life experience?
I believe that was in the rationale for the course.
Of course, nobody reads the rationale. That's true.
Guy.
Got one more question. This will require departments to create rubrics for the evaluation of these portfolios. If there are multiple institutions of higher learning in Kentucky that are going to be involved in this larger, you know, I'll call it Commonwealth College because I forget the acronym it's changed to, but you know, within Commonwealth College, will we face potential problems, say, if English departments across 6 different universities come up with 6 different rubrics? And students begin to shop between those places for the easiest rubric to which their credit applies. Go ahead.
I can answer. The simple answer, Guy, is no. We will not, because one of the subcommittees form to explore this Kahia, think Hawaiian Island, is specifically to address prior learning assessment models so we are all consistent as far as the application of those prior learning assessment models to the adult learners in this Alliance program. Does it mean we have to apply the same standards to absolutely every student? But if a student wants to participate in the Alliance and to go through the Alliance, there's a committee currently working on how to make the process relatively uniform across the state. Yes.
I'm going to entertain Mark's comments, and then I think we need to think about moving along because we have a teetering quorum and we have much important business ahead. Something needs to be done with this. Yes, Mark?
I'll be very quick. I think most of us think this is not a bad idea. I mean, giving credit for prior experience is not a bad idea. What I'd like to see would make me feel better about it is maybe a trigger that says after 1 year or two, we'll have academic quality review this. Something like that worked into it, make me feel much better about this. Just a thought.
I should also clarify that the anticipated use of this is, I think, 3 to 10 a year. It's proposals, yeah. We're not going to get 50 people asking for credit. This is adult learners. This will be people in their 40s and 50s who are coming back to get retrained. I have a motion to approve the policy thing as approved. It has a second, so we've been debating.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Nay.
Nay.
Hands. If you, all those in favor, please stand.
You're going to make me stand up.
Sorry, John, you got to stand. We have 11. We have a quorum of 40. I think the motion fails. I'll make sure that this is prioritized under the new administration.
Well, we have no standing, so I can
go to council. Okay. All those opposed, please stand. Maybe we don't have a quorum.
Yeah,
some okay. All right. 22 to 11 with abstentions. 23 to 11 with abstentions.
Matt, your clarification, one was just broken down.
There were three policies that they grouped together.
Yeah, the motion was all three policies, and what they did was they turned out all three.
Robert?
This may be parliamentarily queasy, but could I move approval for the other two policies? Because the debate was over just one of the three.
Yeah.
That's fine. Do I have a second? Any discussion of the approval of the policies excluding the prior learning portfolio policy? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Policy number 1.3070, evaluation and orientation of student teaching assistants. This had come forward once before, but it needed to be vetted by graduate counsel. Kirk, I think you've done that, is correct?
I'm sorry, I'm not good.
This is 1.3070, yeah. Okay. Second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Number two, policy 1.1120 is being pulled. That policy is still in the hands of the Graduate Council Subcommittee on Policies.
The one thing I'll say about that, just so you know.
Wait, don't say that one. Give me a number.
What is your premium right now?
Okay, 1.1120.
It mentions FACET and the BISCIT program. Maybe we'll take a look at that.
Yeah. Well, y'all are taking a look at it, so.
We'll make some recommended changes.
That'd be great. Okay, policy 1.2121, summer sessions, winter term compensation distribution policy. Any discussion? All those in favor say
yeah. So, technically, the next two should be bundled. They are essentially the same item. The workload policy.
1.21 and 1.2091?
Yeah. They essentially, the two policies talk to each other, therefore, they're a bundle.
Okay, so that's item three and item four co-joined. All right. Second? Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. Handbook committee recommendations. We have seven. So many want to suggest you want to take these one at a time. Do we want to take them one at a time? Okay. Letter A.
I'm the head of Charlie's with conflict of interest, so I think we might at least have that one separate. If anyone else has a conflict, maybe just do that.
Oh, let's just take them one at a time. I think we'll march through them a little quicker that way. Letter A, continuance recommendations. Have a motion for approval?
So moved.
And a second. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? 5B, continuance dates. Motion for approval?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? You said you wanted to discuss C?
Yes.
Conflict of interest.
Okay. Do you mind if I move past that one? Okay, we'll come back to it. Letter D, 008, clarification of of appeal. Second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Letter E, 009, mandatory tenure year.
Move for approval.
Second.
Discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Letter F, 010. Mandatory promotion and tenure.
I would like to comment on this.
Okay. We'll come back to F and then G.
Second.
Ooh.
No.
This is a board of approval, a board of regents approval of the handbook.
I'm sorry. This is the one I want to comment on. I apologize. I skipped ahead. I knew which one it was. I was looking at it. I just didn't realize I was looking at it.
I kind of thought that, John, but I didn't want to say anything.
Well. Some days I'm in.
All right. Let's go back to letter F, mandatory promotion and tenure policy. Second?
Second.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. So I have approvals for A, B, D, E, and F. Let's return to letter C, conflict of interest. Let's get a motion on the floor and then we'll have discussion.
Move to approve.
Second? Okay, or second?
Yeah.
Okay. Discussion?
Before we on.
Letter C.
Conflict of interest.
Conflict of interest. It is number 007.
That's correct.
Specifically with regard to conflict of interest concerning the independence of the candidate's work. I guess I have a few considerations. One is the primary concern here, the independence of the scholarship, or is it primarily the conflict of interest that might be associated with working with this person? Both things are sort of mentioned. I just want to mention a couple things for consideration. If the consideration is primarily that of the independence of the scholarship. If co-authors are outside of the department, there's nothing you're going to be able to do to assess that anyway. I mean, if the that said, if the co-author is within the department of some kind of creative work or scholarly endeavor, it might not be a bad idea to have that person in the committee to discuss this person's contribution. But basically what we're saying here is you might pull that person, the co-author, out of the committee, and then the committee has no way to really assess the candidate's role with regard to publications or grants or whatever it may be. So the person, because that point is this, that scholarship or that grant or whatever is to be in their portfolio, whether that co-author is on the committee or not. But now you've removed potentially the person who can assess that person or speak to their role potentially from this committee. Another point that I just want to raise here is that the way this is written, it assumes that the senior faculty member is carrying the junior faculty member with regard to scholarship here. It very well could be the other way around. And in that case, there is probably a conflict of interest because someone might want to keep this person around to help their own career. And although it says the intent is not to in any way inhibit collaboration, it seems that it's likely an outcome of including this in as far as a potential conflict of interest.
Is there any other discussion? Yes. Microphone. Thank you.
In the music department, for instance, various faculty collaborate on CD recordings, you know, and again, I agree very much that the other people who participated in the work should be excluded from evaluating the candidate.
Yes.
Yeah. Who defines what significant collaboration is within a department? I mean, is it 25% co-authorship? Is it 50% co-authorship? I mean, we have a small department of in terms of the research active faculty, and we often work together. So we just had a tenure decision that, you know, if this policy was in place, we may have all been dismissed from the process. So I have concerns. I mean, when I think of conflict of interest, I don't think of co-authoring with other people. I think that should be removed from the policy. I don't like this idea at all.
There's language in the middle of the second, I guess the end of that description of the scholarly collaboration that says, well, first of all, the scholarly collaboration is said may present a conflict of interest. It doesn't say it does present a conflict of interest. And the following language suggests that the department and the committee members have the opportunity to decide whether, in fact, a given case constitutes conflict of interest. Is that not sufficient to satisfy the concerns that folks are expressing right now?
Somebody want to express their dissatisfaction?
Not really, and I think it specifically says the department head will make that determination. So it would be that individual as opposed to the promotion and rank committee, a larger body. And it's not clear even then how the department head makes that determination if this does constitute a conflict of interest.
Just so everyone knows that we don't do any editing or wordsmithing or amending here. If we turn this down, it goes back to the handbook committee, just so you know that procedurally.
We couldn't have a motion just to...
We do not edit the handbook. You really want to
you told me we couldn't do that on one time previously, I thought. I mean, I'm an absolute not a proponent of editing policy in the Senate. I mean, I think that if there appears to be a lot of concerns on a lot of different fronts here, and I'm not sure that they're easily fixed.
Can we not amend it just to remove the part that talks about the concern? The only concern I've heard raised is the one with regard to co-authorship or working together with regard to conflict of interest.
Where are we, and where is that section?
Paragraph 3. Two lines, Mac, right in the center of the screen. Significant scholarly.
Right here?
Yeah.
So you're...
I would propose that we remove the sentence with the significant scholarship and the following sentence, or two, as two sentences there. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry.
I can't hear the last one.
Okay, I'm sorry. Just that one would suffice.
Can you read the last paragraph?
Yes.
See, it's too messy.
Vote it up or down.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell y'all what to do, but we're going down a bad road here.
Yeah, up or down, send us back.
The motion on the floor is for approval. I'm not trying to...
Well, we've been making this move for a long time. That's fine. We've
Before we do, I have a question for Kelly. Just a question. Does this speak to any other ones that are on the table here? Is this completely independent? I think so. I just want to make sure.
This does not, other than the fact that every place that it refers to, I think, a spouse or domestic partner, it would be replaced with faculty member with a conflict of interest. But that's part of this. That would be replaced if this passes. So that's part of this revision. So no, it doesn't conflict with any other part of the handbook. The second thing is, I think from the handbook committee's perspective, this is not a handbook committee decision. This is a Senate decision. So whatever the Senate decides, the handbook committee will put into place. Handbook committee proposes changes, but I really see it as the handbook committee is only kind of the organizer of what Senate is the final word on this. So if Senate wants to amend it, from my perspective, Senate amends it.
Mac, the reason I think we might not want to amend it on the floor is we also have a question about what you mean by financial relationship, because in our department, every faculty member just wrote a book together. So that would have to be changed at some point, too, or none of us could sit on a tenure committee.
Yes.
Just quick thought to all of those points. Since this isn't a standalone, but I share your concern about the precedent. What I do think is really, really helpful as a member of handbook committee is very specific comments. So, I mean, you can go back and listen to this tape and say, okay, the concerns are X, Y, and Z, and they gave lots of case studies. So this is just really good. That's what I'm saying. That it should be an up or down vote and back to the committee. But I think what you're doing is fantastic because it gives the committee a very clear roadmap, because that's why we have a committee all over the university, is there are no two departments that operate alike.
Any other discussion? All of those in favor of approval say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Nay.
I hate you all.
John, hate's such a strong word, John. Folks who are involved in this discussion, it is incumbent upon you all to send the chair of the handbook committee specific language so that this can end up back here and be approved. So anybody who made comments, please make sure Kelly knows where you think the flaws are so that we can deal with this expediently in the future.
Mr. Chair, let me understand. Kelly, with this not going forward, that means that the rest of the handbook, where it specifically singles out words like spouse, significant other, will stay?
Will stay.
Okay.
The current spouse, domestic partner.
No, it varies. It is highly variable. And causes a great deal of grief for me because I have to interpret, you know, if your son, your father, your uncle is coming up for tenure or promotion, it does not specifically address, therefore I have to allow it. But, okay.
Well.
June is a published
letter G. Board of Regents approval of the handbook.
Robert, motion.
Second, Jennifer. Discussion. Robert.
I obviously want to speak in favor of this motion.
That's what we're doing. That's what we're doing.
Move in a second. We're discussing the Board of Regents now.
The previous handbook revisions have been approved by the Board of Regents, and the heavens haven't fallen, nor have the regents begun to micromanage us. I know that there's a talking point floating out there. In fact, I can date the beginning of that talking point. It was a presentation from the SACS president last summer to department heads. And there was one mention of boards that became too involved, and this was unacceptable. And suddenly I started hearing this from President Ransdale and various Weatherby offices all the time about, we don't want the board too involved. Actually, that's simply a stalking horse for saying we don't want the board asking too many questions. And the fact is, the board's never shown a tendency to become over-involved in academic policy. But there is one large advantage to faculty for having this document approved by the Board of Regents. Once it's approved by them, it cannot be fiddled with until the board passes formally a new set of revisions. And since the faculty handbook is the document that guides our professional life, this is where we go when there are problems about promotion and tenure and relationships between faculty and students. I don't want a moving target. I want a document that is set in stone until the next formal revision. And this simply does that. I do not believe it opens us up to meddling from the board on a line-by-line basis. But it does prevent meddling below the board level, and it has to be formally presented through all the chain. The board approves it. That's the law of the land until the next time they approve revisions.
Any other discussion? John?
All of which is well and good until the board decides to meddle. I personally don't feel any need to have the governing board approve this because by Senate charter, we publish a new document, a new handbook, every July. July 1, it becomes effective. Does not require a Board of Regents approval to become effective. That's in our charter. It's written that way. I would rather, if they want to take a look at it, I'll be more than happy to run them a copy over at any Board of Regents meeting that they want to read it. I don't feel a pressing need to have them certify this document when we publish it ourselves. It is our document. I have no interest in having somebody else approve a decision that we made with regards to our handbook. And that's my primary objection to this. They didn't approve it last year. Seems to have worked just fine.
Is there any other discussion? Patty?
I would argue, and I did argue at the time, that the handbook should have been approved by the Board of Regents last time. And every version of the handbook prior to the 18th edition was approved by the Board of Regents. And in the intervening years between the 17th and the 18th editions, when there were various substantive matters of the type that we've been dealing with right now, the Academic Affairs Committee of the board saw all of those and approved them and sent them on to the full board, which is simply the board doing its fiduciary responsibility. And until the implementation of the policy on policies in 2010, is that the correct year? 2010-ish, 11-ish, yeah, something like that. Until then, this was not an issue. The argument that the president has made since the approval of the policy on policies is that policy on policies means that's where the buck stops and that's the final word on everything. I think that is a dangerous precedent. I've made that view very clear both to President Ransdell and to Provost Emsley. I think it leaves the university exposed from a legal standpoint. One of these days, I'd hate to be proven right on that, but I think we're absolutely exposed if we don't approve the handbook. Other institutions send all of their handbooks to their governing boards. It's just best practices. We followed it until extremely recently, and I concur with everything my colleague Robert, who sat in the regent's chair during the years that all that handbook stuff went to the board, and nobody line item, the board bylaws don't allow us to line item edit. So it's an up or down vote, right? It is for your protection. It protects the faculty. Because if you have a legal action, right, who are you suing? Okay, this protects you. It protects somebody from being able to pull that down and put it back up. I have no idea why any faculty member would vote against this revision. If somebody up the line wants to veto it, they have the power to do it, but I think this should come forward every year until it's installed as best practices, and that's just going to become another thing that the board votes up or down on a unanimous vote, but we will all be protected, and we will all, faculty and administration, be better for it.
John.
Well, the idea of it protecting us from a lawsuit is bunkum. For lawyers, if it's a student, they have a great appeal. They're not going to sue the university. They're going to sue the university, the registrar, and me. They're going to put everybody's name down on it, just by virtue of the fact that I was related to them. Again, we aren't required to get board approval. It's our document. I don't feel the need to get board approval. I don't sleep better at night knowing that the board has approved it in the past, and I slept just fine last year when the board didn't approve it that time either. So I'm ready for a vote. I don't mind otherwise.
Is there any other discussion? All those in favor of approval say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it.
Yep.
Any other parting thoughts before we bust out of here and enjoy our productive and safe summers? Entertain a motion to adjourn. Second. All those in favor? Yay.
Yeah.
I think the moving chairs have it.
Yeah.